The township of Dickens, California, has been wiped off the map. It hasn't been destroyed. The houses still exist. The people still live there. But the mark of an official's pen has taken the community away. So one man decides, haphazardly, to bring it back with a slave he didn't ask for and by reintroducing segregation. The Sellout by Paul Beatty is the winner of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction for 2016. Paul Beatty is speaking with Sky Kirkham.
Paul Beatty, welcome to RN.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, this novel begins in a fairly unusual place with a black American man in court for owning a slave. Where did this idea come to you?
That's a good question. I think the idea came, I don't know, people are just always throwing around these words, segregation and these examinations of the civil rights era and slavery and talking about all these historical things, you know, as history in retrospect. And I just thought it'd be really interesting to kind of explore the same themes, but in a contemporary context, like what would these things look like now? And it was a challenge, but I had a good time trying to figure it out.
Yeah, because one of the interesting things as you sort of build through is you do poke at what I would think of as a lot of sacred cows, the idea of segregation as having any potential value is not something that would normally, I think, be raised.
Yeah, I mean, I think occasionally you'll hear, like, an academic talk about, like, how African Americans were better off economically and socially and educationally under segregation, you know, because they more or less had to, you know, run their own communities and run businesses. I mean, you know, the options were limited, so there was, like, a sense of supporting each other. During the last election, there were some black and white conservatives who were saying, you know, like the black family was better off during slavery. It's just, I don't know, you hear this kind of stuff occasionally. And so I just wanted to have fun with it. And, you know, and the slavery part I don't understand, but the segregation part, I at least understand the sentiment, even if I don't understand the morals of it. And so I just really wanted to test that and try to push that idea to its limits. You know, and at the same time, there's still a ton of de facto segregation in the States that people don't talk about as segregation. And so, I just kind of try to overlap these thoughts.
That's one of the really interesting things going through this book, because I mean, on the surface, it seems almost like, you know, raising these things that shouldn't be said, but you're using it to give critiques that almost feel like they couldn't occur without the surrealism, the absurdity of the basic idea. Does that let you jump into things you wouldn't otherwise be able to attack?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know about that. I mean, I think you could do it in a less, less absurd way. I think, life is absurd anyways. And I think, you know, life as a black person can be absurd. I mean, life as anybody can be absurd, but, you know, I think there are certain absurdities that can go with who you are. And, you know, there's so much of a disconnect between, you know, whatever the American dream is supposed to be and how you pursue it, how it gets parceled out to you, that I can't even explain it. And being poor is absurd. And it's just, this is going to sound weird. I don't know why I'm telling you this, but I was in Hawaii once with a friend of mine, and we were driving through, and my friend remarked how the native Hawaiians just seem kind of sad in a weird way. You know, we're making these broad generalizations, of course, as people want to do. And then my friend said, yeah, you know why they're so sad? It's because they're broken paradise. You know, and you're in this beautiful place, but you can't participate in it. There's a weird kind of irony there. Maybe it's not absurdity, but, you know, and I just kind of how I see the world. And in a weird way, those things are fun for me to explore.
It's just the sort of things that you're interested in that get reflected in what you end up writing?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I kind of tend to, I had a professor say about myself once that I'm always looking in the wrong direction. Like everyone else is looking one way and I'm looking the other way. And it's just how I do it. So I just... Not something I try to do necessarily, but I just kind of look at things from the outside in or inside out. I'm not even sure which it is. And so I just have fun with it. And then some of the stuff that reads as absurd is not absurd. It's actually sort of based in reality. So, like, in the book, you know, there's this kind of inner-city agrarian community. And, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and the book is set in L.A., and there's, like, a section of a city called Compton that's zoned for agriculture. So you drive through this area, and, you know, you see people on horseback, and you see cows, you know, grazing in the street medians, and, you know, it's just a strange, strange place that no one in L.A. knows about. And I was always shocked that people just didn't know that this area existed.
And this is Compton, because, I mean, I think a lot of people would know Compton from the hip-hop that references I've never pictured that as agrarian.
No, and it's not like it's the whole city. I mean, it's weird. California is agrarian in large part. I mean, it's a huge agricultural state. And there are pockets in California where you see this. So you can see, if you go to Richmond, California, which is up north, there's another, you know, the typical person who thinks of Richmond thinks of this rough, you know, kind of downtrodden city. But if you drive through there, you'll see people on horseback. And then this part, it's not all of Compton. It's just like this weird kind of small area. And so people have cows. My sister tells stories. She teaches in Compton, and my sister tells stories of students that buy their lunch milk from the cow next door, you know, for 50 cents or whatever. Yeah, so it's just, you know, she would tell me these stories, and I was like, yeah, I forgot about that. And for me, it was like the perfect setting to talk about all these kind of other absurd things. But one of the things that was hard about the book and writing the book was to get this place that's fictional but sort of based on a real place to make that place feel absurd and real at the same time. That took forever to figure out how to do.
When we think of the great American novel, there is a sort of typical form that I think we think of, but I have to say, reading this to me felt like reading possibly the most American book I've ever read. But it's not the America we typically see. It's not apple pies or even oil fields. Yeah. It's one that actually acknowledges that there were slaves, there's inequality, and it hasn't quite recovered from that. Obviously, we get a limited range of American cultural output here. But is that something that is part of the American cultural experience, an acknowledgement of the past, or is there an attempt to get rid of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends. I think people use the past for their own ends. So, for instance, Trump is running under this campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, which is obviously, you know, a huge allusion to a past. But, you know, Americans of all backgrounds like to refer to America, that depends when, that, you know, never really exists. And the country's never who it thinks it is. You know, that's just probably true in most places, I think. But, so, I mean, I think that's true. But I think also when it comes to, you know, the more difficult parts of America's history, is people like to deal with it in the past. And so that's one thing that, I don't know, doesn't interest me all that much usually, is to deal with all this stuff in a contemporary setting, you know, in a place that shows us that, to some extent, we're all accountable. But I think, and I'm just going to speak for Americans, but we have a hard time dealing with that. So I'm not sure why that is. But, I mean, but, you know, historical fiction is big in the States, and the States love to talk about the World War II generation, but it's always, let's talk about this, but ignore that this was going on at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, it's easy to look beyond the borders, perhaps, rather than inside them. Your central suburb, where all of this is set, in Dickens, you have a comment that everyone there is black, no matter their ethnicity. And it actually shocks one of the kids in the book to realize that she's Hispanic. She's not African-American.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you have this setup as race as a construct in a book that is so grounded. It feels in the ideas of race. I mean, is it all a construct for you?
Is race all a construct? That's a good, very, very good question. I think, I think, you know, like race, like identities, is very mutable. I mean, it depends where you are. It depends what day it is. It depends who's looking at you and who you're looking at, you know? So it's hard to say. I don't want to say that it's a construct 100% of the time, because it's not, you know? And, it's just so situational. You know, and at the same time, you know, there are things now where the idea of race is being tied to class in different ways. You know, like, I guess in the States, and I guess I'm hearing a lot about it here, I'm in England at the moment, you know, people are talking about cultural appropriation and who can do what. And people, it's interesting to see how people are, how tied they are to these constructs of themselves that aren't necessarily real, but they just don't want anyone else using them. Yeah, you can't use my sombrero, you can't use my lederhosen, these things belong to me. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that, to be honest. You know, I wish I did. Like, I wish I could say, yeah, race is a construct, let's all be positive, it doesn't really exist, it's something in our mind. And there's some truth to that, but, you know, in the real world, that's just not the case.
And I mean, I have to say, you know, ignoring the dreadful quality of my writing, I read a book like this, and there is no way that I could write a book like this, because this feels like something that could only be written from someone who has an insider's knowledge of the cultural aspects of it.
Well, Sky, I would like to think that I'm the only one alive that can write the book.
You know, I wouldn't debate that,
I'm usually not a braggart like that. But I can't believe I just said that. Yeah, I mean, I try to look at things differently, you know, and I guess I just do. I try to see past stuff that we don't want to see, you know, or the stuff we pretend to see. I mean, that's what I try to do.
Paul, this book it's really funny. It had me laughing out loud constantly through the book. And something you wrote is that humor is vengeance. So talk to me about the value or the use of humor in a book like this. Does it keep it light enough to read, or is there a depth to it?
I hope there's a depth. I mean, you know, usually humor is pretty smart. I mean, humor can go places where, you know, it can be more difficult to go. But, I mean, did I say humor is vengeance? I mean, I think it can be. Humor can be a lot of things. But sometimes it's, you know, it can be all you have in the moment. I think everybody kind of knows that. And it's not something, I don't think of myself as like a humorous writer, I guess. You know, I kind of write and the jokes, I'm not like searching for jokes necessarily most of the time. It's just how I see it, and it's just how I deal with it, I guess.
Well, it's funny in the same kind of way that Heller's funny. It's that it's not
that hell is funny.
Joseph Heller. It's that kind of, like, it's not.
Oh, Heller's funny.
It's not laugh out loud punchline, but it's just these really, I don't know, this different way of describing the world.
I remember being, I don't know how old I was. I was pretty young. I must have been like 13, I guess, 14 maybe, and reading Catch 22, and I love that book. I mean, that book has stayed with me for so long. And, I mean, it was funny and it was so smart, but I think the thing I really like about it just was so important and so elucidating about, you know, the ridiculousness, not of just war, but how we talk about war, how we think about life and death. I don't know. That book really just, I can't say it changed my life or anything. But, yeah, and he's one of many writers. Like, you know, I'm not the only one who does this. But, yeah, that book just popped into mind when you mentioned him.
I described this before as possibly the most American book I'd read. I was wondering, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm in a different country and I loved it.
Yeah.
But were you surprised to get the positive reception from an English prize, the international recognition?
Yeah, maybe. I think so, maybe. It's funny you say that because, you know, I had just started the book and I ran into an old friend who's actually now passed away, a guy named Roland Mora, who started a place called the Near Recent Poets Cafe in New York. And we were talking, and he was telling me, like, you know, America needs a kick in the ass. You know, no one's saying anything. I was just starting my book. And even when he said that, it was a weird thing because I don't normally think this way, but I was like, oh, my gosh, my book is so American somehow. But I have to say, yeah, I was surprised. You know, I was very surprised.
Paul Beatty, and he is the winner of this year's Man Booker Prize for Fiction with his novel The Sellout, which is published in Australia by Bloomsbury. And Paul Beatty was speaking there with Sky Kirkham. And one of the women, one of the writers who was tipped to win this year's Man Booker, Deborah Levy, was interviewed by Sarah Lestrange on Monday for Books and Arts. You can have a listen to that interview at the Books and Arts website, along with a bunch of interviews with other of the shortlisted writers for this year's prize. Just go along to abc.net.au/RN and go to the Books and Arts page to find all of those. And I'd love to hear your opinion. If you've read some of the books that were shortlisted, do you think the judges got it right? Get onto the Books and Arts page on Facebook, or you can always tweet us. We'd love to hear what you think. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and you are with Books and Arts.